I mean, in Syria, you know. So, and this is where it gets really crazy. You know? So, it's just sort of the serious tragedy of trying to impose military solutions on complex political problems, and just shows the folly and the tragedy that comes from U.S. military interventionism.
So, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think. I would like to think that we can see where it's going. It's going in an absolutely abysmally catastrophic direction. Following it is. It's difficult to predict, and I'm not going to ask you to make any predictions. Do you have any sources that you could suggest to listeners? We like to give people somewhere to go to.
One Cole, a historian at the University of Michigan, he has a thing called Informed Comment, which can be found at onecole.org, J-U-A-N-C-O-L-E, One Cole. He's had a number of excellent analysis that's come out just in the past few days that I and others have been relying on. That's one of the first places I would go.
Thank you so much for that. We've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Zunis. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. He's a coordinator of the program in the Middle Eastern Studies and one of the country's leading scholars on the Middle East. Thanks again for that, Stephen. We're glad to have you back on the KBOO Airways. This has been Echo Cascadia for Monday, June 16th, 2014. Kate Welch engineered the show. Thanks for that, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson, the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the third annual Evening with Wisdom of the Elders, Friday, June 20th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. A night with Wisdom of the Elders takes place at the Melody Ballroom, 614 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. It includes a salmon dinner and a silent auction, as well as speeches and a cultural arts presentation. Again, that's a night with Wisdom of the Elders, Friday, June 20th at 6:30 p.m. at the Melody Ballroom in Portland. More information about this event may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson sitting in today on Locus Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest is Andrew Kimbrell, Executive Director and Founder of the Center for Food Safety. Andrew Kimbrell is an internationally recognized voice and leading public interest lawyer in the fight to protect the environment and the public from the threats of global industrial agriculture and faulty government policies. He's the author of Your Right to Know, Genetic Engineering and the Secret Changes to Your Food, published in 2006. Andrew Kimbrell, thanks very much for coming into KBOO today.
I'm delighted to be here.
You set up the Center for Food Safety in 1997?
That's correct, yeah.
What has the role of the center been in responding to the introduction of genetically engineered seed in the U.S.?
Well, interestingly enough, at least I think it's interesting, when the Center for Food Safety started in December of 1997, that was the date when Dan Glickman, then head of the USDA, came out with the proposed rules for what would be acceptable as organic. Mm-hmm. And in those rules, he said, well, maybe Maybe we can use genetic engineering. Maybe we can use sewage sludge. Maybe we can use irradiation as acceptable organic practices. And so at that point, the Center for Safety had just been a project of another organization I had. And I said, wait a minute, we cannot let organic be destroyed. And I'd been part of the group that helped pass the Organic Food Production Act of 1990. Organic was going to be the beachhead of a new food future for America. And darn it, we weren't going to allow that to happen. So we got together with several other groups, and CFS started by really organized around the country saying, just say no to these proposed rules. And 300,000 people did. And the Clinton administration gave in, and they said, okay, you win. And that's why today genetic engineering and sewage sludge and irradiation are prohibited methods under the organic rule. So that's how we really got started, by protecting organic. And that's really still the fundamental thing about Center for Food Safety. You know, we call ourselves, you know, the group that's for organic and beyond.
Right.
We think organic isn't the ceiling of the food future. We think it's the floor. And above that floor, just the floor, important floor, but above that floor, we want to build a future of food that's local, an appropriate scale, and humane. Very important. I mean, 10 billion animals, terrible cruelty done to them every year that we use for food, socially just and biodiverse. And with local and biodiverse, that'll also help us deal with climate destabilization. So think of organic as the floor, and above it, this new house of the future of food that we're trying to all build together. And that's the kind of the vision we have. And GMOs, genetic engineering, don't go with any of that. Right. I mean, they add 140 million more pounds of pesticides every year to what we're doing. They are there to really help grow corn and soy. Now, that's corn and soy are over 50% of all of our farmland is being devoted in America to corn and soy. Can you imagine? And 97-98% of corn and soy go to cattle or cars or chickens. Almost none of it is fed to us. And that, which is usually high fructose corn syrup and soy lecithin stuff that's put in processed foods. So if you look at local, if you look at appropriate scale, if you look at biodiverse, these are monocultures, and if you look at social justice, it's the high seed prices and added pesticides force farmers out of work. GMOs just have no place in that future of food that we're looking at.
Genetically engineered seed was promoted as being a technology with great promise to feed the world's hungry, and still there are people that seem to bring that up when that kind of seed is criticized. What has been the reality with this?
Well, we have to remember who is producing this, right? I mean, you know, the big companies are Monsanto, DuPont, Dow, Syngenta, and Bayer. What do they share? They're all chemical companies. They've never been interested in feeding the world, and they still aren't. They're interested in selling chemicals, because that's what chemical companies do. And we got to give them credit, folks. They've done a pretty good job. I mean, playing with some bacterial DNA, they were able to create plants that when you sprayed herbicides, that's weed killer, on these crops, instead of killing the crops with the weeds, which they normally would do, right? These things kill everything that's green. They had enough of herbicide resistance in the crops, so the crops survive and only the weeds die. So that made it a lot easier for large farmers. They didn't have to be careful with their herbicide use. They could aerial spray, which they do, their soy fields and their corn fields with hundreds of millions of more pounds of these toxic herbicides. Great for Monsanto. They're selling the seeds and the additional herbicides, and admittedly more convenient for the large farmers. They don't have to be careful with their toxic herbicide use. Terrible for the rest of us. Terrible for polluting our rivers. Terrible for destruction of non-target organisms. Terrible for our health as they've ratcheted up the tolerance levels these herbicides can be in our food, in our bodies, and those of our children and communities. So a really good bottom line idea. Does it increase food? No. Union Concerned Scientists came out with a great report called Failure to Yield about this. So that pretty much tells the story. They're not trying to grow more food. That's just greenwashing or hunger washing, if you will, their technology. Mm-hmm. This technology, 85% of all the plants grown in this country and around the world are grown for one reason alone, and that is because they have these herbicide-tolerant DNA, which allows for this massive spraying and huge profits for these companies. So it's nothing to do with more nutrition, less herbicide, less pesticide use, which is a real joke since they're selling their herbicides, using more of it. Hunger, this is all just a whitewash on a technology that really is about chemical companies selling more chemicals.
And so when you hear the propaganda, I guess you would call it, of someone saying this is really going to be the solution in this specific poor country where people are starving, how do you respond?
Well, first of all, we know that the UN has done studies. We've done studies from Michigan State that the way to feed people is a diverse food supply. That's how to feed people, usually small and medium farms, saving seeds. Here we have a technology which is devoted to these huge monocultures. We cannot live by corn and soy. And what they're doing, sadly, and they're trying to do, and this is the Gates Foundation I'm talking about. This is Monsanto. And unfortunately, even our USAID in America. What they're doing is they're spreading a technology to try and have these countries grow genetically engineered corn for fuel. Instead of using their land for food, using it for fuel. And so quite the opposite. It's not going to feed anybody. You're taking land away from food land and turning it into something that you'll have fuel with.
Monsanto, Dow, and other biotech corporations are about to release a second generation of genetically engineered seed. And you have stated that the U.S. is at peak herbicide. So what are the dangers of these new GE seeds?
So what we're seeing is with this massive use of herbicides, mostly Roundup, you know, Darwin showed up, you know, evolution showed up. And so now we have in the United States about 50% of all farmland has some Roundup-resistant weeds. That means weeds that you can't kill with Roundup. And so the solution obviously is don't keep doing this. But that's not a good solution for the chemical companies. So Dow Chemical has said, aha, we want to inherit Monsanto's market, especially in corn and soy and cotton, which is a huge percentage of all the GMO crops out there. And we want to make them resistant to our favorite herbicide, 2,4-D. Now, 2,4-D was an element in Agent Orange. So they're going back to an old herbicide, and they're saying, okay, now that these weeds can't be killed with Roundup, we're going to have these seeds that are resistant to 2,4-D, so now you can spray your corn and soy fields with 2,4-D. And according to our own USDA, that will increase by 3 to 7 times the amount of 2,4-D already used. So we're already using about 46 million pounds of 2,4-D, so we could be looking at 350 million more pounds of 2,4-D. Now, 2,4-D, you know, it sounds scary, element of Agent Orange, but it is scary. It's been associated with a number of diseases, including Parkinson's disease and certain cancers. It is a toxic herbicide. And the idea that we would be increasing up to 7 times more is really, really, you know, it's a terrible prospect. But what makes it even worse is that the weeds will eventually, and they already some of them already are, but they're going to get, of course, resistant to 2,4-D as well, 5, 10, 15 years down the line. So meanwhile, we will have had this huge load of hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds, millions and millions of pounds of this 2,4-D in our environment, in our bodies, in our streams, you know, killing our wildlife, hurting farm workers. And meanwhile, it'll become obsolescent as well. Now, Monsanto, not to be outdone, has now invented corn, soy, and cotton again that are resistant to dicamba. Most people don't know what dicamba is, but it's an even more toxic, even more dangerous herbicide than 2,4-D. So Roundup ain't great, folks. 2,4-D is even worse. Dicamba is even worse, both in its health impacts and its impacts on farmers. Because what dicamba can do, and 2,4-D as well, but dicamba is really good at this, it's called volatilize. And that means that under warm and wet conditions, after you spray it, so here, imagine here, an airplane comes in, sprays dicamba over huge cornfield or soy field. It reconstitutes itself up in a cloud after being sprayed in a cloud and travels. So let's say you have your lovely organic corn field 2 miles away, a mile away, or your apple orchard. It comes down and will kill it. Remember, it's a herbicide. It'll kill everything. And you don't have the herbicide tolerance. You don't have the gene that makes a tolerance for that, the DNA. So this volatilization has really scared a lot of people, as it should. And a lot of even conventional farmers, Del Monte kind of farm, conventional farmers, there's something called Save Our Crops Coalition here in the Northwest. They are terrified of dicamba and are pleading with the government not to approve it. So what we're seeing is a chemical arms race going backwards. We're at peak herbicides. We don't have any really new ones. So we're going from Roundup, which, you know, wide spectrum and not considered that harmful, to more harmful, more toxic herbicides, 2,4-D, and then dicamba, and that'll all be stacked together. So you'll have corn and soy that will be resistant to Roundup, 2,4-D, and dicamba. You know, millions and millions of acres, over 50% of our farmland. Imagine that toxic load. That is the nightmare future that these chemical companies have for us. And it's planned obsolescence. 10 to 15 years down the line, all the weeds will be resistant to them. We don't have any more herbicides after that. It'll be a tragedy, a catastrophe for American farmers because they won't know how to kill the weeds after that. So this is the road they want to take us down, and unfortunately, servants, shall we say, in the government who should be looking after us and farmers instead of looking after these few chemical companies are okaying these things. Now, we've stopped a bunch of them through litigation. Center for Safety is very good at that. But still, if we don't succeed in stopping these through litigation and through grassroots organizing, this is a terrible future. This is exactly the reverse future. We talked about that organic and beyond future of, you know, local and humane and healthy a food system that is fundamentally based in a regenerative, healthy society. Instead, we're going the opposite direction. We're going to really a toxic nightmare. And a planned obsolescence toxic nightmare. That is really the future that Monsanto and the rest of these chemical companies have for us, and we have to say no.
I'm speaking with Andrew Kimbrell. He is the executive director and founder of the Center for Food Safety. He's also the author of Your Right to Know, Genetic Engineering and the Secret Changes in Your Food. And you just alluded to this, but you are a public interest lawyer and you've litigated issues all the way to the Supreme Court. What has been the federal government's response to genetically engineered seed, and specifically the agencies like the FDA, the USDA, and the EPA?
Well, you know, let's start with the good news. You know, sometimes I speak all over the place. I just came back from Hawaii, where we passed some really good bills on the island of Kauai and on the Big Island, where one saying you have to tell us, biotech companies, chemical companies, all the chemicals you're using, because our school children are getting sick, people are getting ill, and that passed. And we're fighting that in court now because the Syngenta and Dow and DuPont have sued to stop that. On the Big Island, there's a ban now on GMOs, any new GMOs. They haven't yet attacked that in court. So it's really exciting, this new food revolution that's going on. And that's not all. People forget, you know. And they always say, oh my gosh, you can't stop Monsanto, you can't stop Dow. And let's not forget Dow, because they're 2,4-D. People always talk about Monsanto. Let's remember Dow in there, because their 2,4-D crops are the next generation. They're the new Monsanto. But, you know, over the years, if you looked at, and I'm not just talking about the Center for Food Safety, I'm very proud of the work we've done, but all of our allies, we have stopped genetically engineered tomatoes. We have stopped genetically engineered potatoes. We have stopped genetically engineered wheat. We have stopped the commercialization of genetically engineered rice. We, through amazing work done here in Oregon and elsewhere, were able to have Monsanto have to sell its flagship product, bovine growth hormone. They sold it because they knew it wasn't being profitable anymore because of the great activism. We have halted the idea of genetically engineered salmon for almost 12 years now, and they still aren't approving it. You know, we've stopped genetically engineered bent grass. This has been in schools and golf courses everywhere. We've stopped biopharmaceuticals. This was the idea of genetically engineered plants so they'd grow vaccines in the plants. Stop that through litigation. Completely stopped it. So we have beaten them over and over again. Imagine our world right now. Imagine the toxic pollution we'd see with these herbicides. Imagine the toxins we'd see in our foods if genetically engineered wheat and rice. Imagine all the products and tomatoes and potatoes and all of these things had happened. But they were stopped, and we can stop them together, all of us. We can stop these products, and we have. Unfortunately, we've had to do all of this in spite of the federal government. The USDA especially has been in the pocket of these biotech companies. We've sued them successfully over and over again. But that's not the way it should work. It shouldn't be regulation through litigation. The only time they move is when we win a litigation. Then they do their environmental impact statement, or then they pull back a product. And the same has been true with the FDA. From the beginning now, they should have had mandatory testing and mandatory labeling of genetically engineered foods. You know, every one of these companies has gone to the patent office and they have patented the novel DNA, the novel viral DNA that they're using in these crops. They've got dozens of patents, Monsanto and the other companies. So they go into the patent office and this is completely novel. This has never been, we've never seen these viral DNA in these, they call them viral promoters. We've never seen them in food before. Here's the novel BT or the novel HT genetic construct. Never seen that in foods before, never done. Here's the vector. This is the bacteria we use to invade the cell to deposit the new DNA. We're patenting that. It's never been in food before. Here are the markers genes we find to see if we're successful or not, which usually react to kanamycin or ampicillin. Never seen them in food before. We're getting a patent. And then they go to the FDA, and the FDA says there's nothing new here. These are substantially equivalent with normal foods. Well, that's schizophrenia at the federal level. If it's novel and they're getting a patent, it's never been in food before, all this novel DNA, and it's in every cell. Let me remind you, every cell, the nucleus of every cell of that food. And if it's novel enough for a patent, because it's never been in food before, I think it's novel enough for us as consumers to be able to know, to get that food labeled. They can't have it both ways.
Yeah. Why does the FDA say that?
Well, because the FDA at the time was captured by the industry. Michael Taylor and several of the people at the FDA who set this policy in 1992, it was under Dan Quayles. People remember? Probably some of this audience may be old enough to remember our old friend Dan, Vice President Quayle. He's had something called the Competitiveness Council. Remember, Dan couldn't quite spell potatoes, as you remember. He had a little problem. But apparently he was competent enough to decide that genetically engineered foods were, quotes, the substantial equivalents of other foods. And it was really at the end of that Bush administration in 1992, they set up this, you know, this policy. It still isn't a regulation, a policy, no mandatory labeling and no mandatory testing. Now, 1992, later on, when the Clinton administration, they began to reconsider this, but then under pressure from the biotech industry, they pulled back. So that's sadly where we still are today. No mandatory testing, no mandatory labeling. But the good news is that, you know, with this food revolution that we're seeing, we just saw Jackson County here in Oregon and Josephine County say, no. And we have our office here was involved in that. We have a wonderful CFS office, Center for Food Safety Office here in Portland was involved in that, and we're delighted to have helped. In California, or San Francisco, we have another CFS office and many of our attorneys down there. You know, we have Mendocino County, and we've got Trinity County and Marin County and Santa Cruz County all have said no to GMOs. I mentioned what's going on in Hawaii. And of course, we had the, you know, the wonderful situation where Vermont became the very first state in the country just recently to say, we want the labeling of these genetically engineered foods. No trigger, no, it's going to happen. Then Connecticut and Maine have also said, you know, we want labeling, but they want some other states to join them. But right now, Vermont, I didn't tell you this when we first started talking. I have kind of ESP.
Okay.
I really do. And I'm going to predict for you right now what the second state is going to be that's going to have labeling. Oregon. Because we're going to win in November.
Yeah.
We're going to win in November. We're going to get labeling. The people have a right to know of all of this novel DNA in our food. It's never been proven safe. But the important thing in labeling to remember is we don't label foods that are dangerous. We take them off the market. I hear somebody that says, well, you haven't proven it's dangerous, so it shouldn't be labeled. That's not why FDA orders labeling. If you look at the back of your cereal, your breakfast cereal, look at all that stuff. FDA, we may disagree. Matter of fact, I'm pretty sure we probably do. But the FDA says, that's all safe. But you, by just looking at it, wouldn't know all that red dye number two and all that other stuff's in there, right? You look at all these complicated chemicals that they list, right? They don't list them, the FDA, because they're unsafe. They list them because they think you have the right to know. If they were unsafe, they would be taken off the market. So we want labeling at this point of genetically engineered foods because it contains patented, let me remind you, patented novel material never seen in foods before. And we as the consumers can't tell. We look at an ear of corn, another ear of corn, it's impossible to say. We look at packaged food, it's impossible to say. We have the right to know that that contains novel genetic material never, ever seen in food before. When we do get enough tests, and we're beginning to see some evidence of this around the world, to see that some of this stuff may be very dangerous or potentially dangerous, that's different. Then we don't want to label them. Then we'll say, let's take them off the supermarket shelf. So don't, you know, a lot of people fall for that argument going, gosh, you know, it's true, they haven't been proven dangerous. Why should, we don't label because we dangerous because it's novel, because there's a material change in the food we as consumers have the right to know about. If we find out it's dangerous, we're going to have another movement, which is say, let's get that dangerous food off those shelves.
Going a little bit further with that idea, we in Oregon were right next to Washington State when they had their vote on the issue of labeling. Mm-hmm. And we could see the ads, the bombardment of commercials, and we know that these companies have huge amounts of money. I mean, compared to the Center for Food Safety, its whole budget. So what can actually be a counterbalance to that?
Well, you know, it's important to remember in California and sadly in Washington State, we lost by a very small margin. You know, in California, where I was very closely involved and my organization co-wrote both of those and the Oregon Ballot Initiative. We were co-authors of that and proud of it. They outspent us, they spent, I think, 48, 47, close to $50 million. I know it was $20 million plus in Washington. So they've spent over $70 million to stop our right to know. Against, you know, usually one-fifth that amount for all the organizations that we're doing. So, and we're probably going to see that again in Oregon, no question about it. But I think people are getting wise. I think they're seeing what's happening. I think Vermont broke the ice. And another thing that I think that we haven't quite used enough of this, in my view, and this is no criticism of the campaigns in California or Washington. It's David and Goliath stuff. But we haven't quite done the ground game that we need to do. What we have that they don't have, we need to compete on television. People need to give money to these campaigns. And we need to compete on radio. No question about it. But we have, they don't, we can go to the streets. We can go door to door. Monsanto can't go door to door. What are they going to say? We want to pollute your... No, they don't do that. But we can. There's a number on 1-866-620-2762. Let me repeat that. 866-620-2762. And there's also an email address, Oregon Right to Know. It's all one word, OregonRightToKnow.org. And you can also go to our website, Center for Food Safety, centerforfoodsafety.org, and get involved. You know, we know if we have thousands and thousands of volunteers getting the signatures, which I'm convinced we will, no problem. We're going to get on the ballot. But that's not the point. What we weren't able to do in Washington and in California was to get those same people to get thousands and thousands and thousands of volunteers to get the vote out. This is really important when a state like this, where you have mail ballots, where people aren't going in one day where you can get the buses and get rid of the... No, people have to take that effort. We were ahead in the polls all the way to the end in Washington. It's just a lot of people thought we were going to win anyway and didn't bother to mail in their ballots. We cannot let that happen again. So I'm pleading with anybody who's interested in this issue, anybody who agrees with us on the issue that you have the right to know, contact either the OregonRightToKnow.org or centerforsafety.org, and we can make sure that you can become a volunteer and you can canvass neighborhoods. And we got to go full court press between now and November, because that's what we have. That's the advantage we have, is the people. They can flood the airways. They can buy out all the TV time. They already bought out a huge amount of it in radio time. Doesn't make any difference. If we can compete enough on the radio and television, and then we can go door to door and explain, we will win in Oregon. I promise you.
You've said that you have had to fight vigorously against all three branches of the federal government. Can you talk about some of the specifics of the work that you did in that way? I mean, how you actually were successful in these suits?
Well, you know, I shouldn't say me. I should say my great legal and science team, mm-hmm. I go around and talk a lot and raise some money, but I'm an attorney myself, so I'm not completely out of it. But we at Center for Safety have, and here in Oregon as well, we have a wonderful team in our office here in Portland, and a great team in San Francisco and in D.C., and also a new team in Honolulu to fight there at Ground Zero, which I'm real pleased that we're doing. It's administrative law. You know, it sounds very romantic, you know, that you're an environmental attorney or you're a food law attorney. It's pretty slow going. You have to go through a lot of administrative laws, and we've filed laws under FIFRA and RCRA and NEPA and all those acronyms, but they're very important, we've been able through those to be able to stop a number of crops. I mentioned them before, and unfortunately, and I say this with a great deal of disappointment, the Obama administration has been even worse than the Bush administration on this issue.
Really?
Yeah. I'm very sad to say that. Obama, when he was campaigning in 2008, said he was for labeling. Michelle, had the organic garden. And so it's been with great disappointment. And part of this is because Secretary Tom Vilsack at the United States Department of Agriculture, a former biotechnology industrial organization governor of the year, governor of Iowa. Mm-hmm. So very much into the corn, very much in a law firm that he worked for after being governor. Was actually one of the law firms that opposed us in the Supreme Court when we won the alfalfa case. And they're pretty much, they represent Pioneer, which is DuPont. So we have seen, and the lawyer that now is the counsel for USDA was taken directly from DuPont, went directly from the company DuPont into the USDA. So very sadly, the USDA is pretty much captured now by these chemical companies, and Vilsack certainly. And it's a shame. And it's not only they have taken the position for the first time. Certainly the Bush administration never took this position, that they really have no regulatory power to regulate genetically engineered crops, that their hands are tied. They interpret their statute to say, well, we really can't regulate whether this how much more herbicide and whether it's going to hurt anybody. Oh, we really can't regulate if it's going to kill endangered species. We really can't do that. So that's been the way they try to avoid this, by saying, hey, we can't even regulate these crops. No one's ever said that. No one's ever tried to completely abnegate all their responsibility for this. So it's really a a sad moment. And then, and we've even seen recently now, only recently, but even kind of a hostility towards organic, which we saw in the Bush administration, but the early Obama administration was very friendly to organic. And remember, Center for Safety fights for organic every day. We have full-time people who do nothing to make sure those standards stay, have the integrity that they have. And it's been unfortunate to see even see that begin to degrade. Not quite sure why. I wish I could, on your show, break some news about what inside White House person is doing all of this. We're a little bit mystified ourselves, but it is certainly disappointing. And we have seen this at the FDA as well. Peggy Hamburg has been extremely hostile to any kind of labeling of genetically engineered foods. I mean, she's not really a food person. She used to be a health commissioner in New York City. We just have seen hostility there. EPA, not much support there. We like what EPA is doing on climate destabilization. We were part of the lawsuit that, you know, that forced EPA to actually address greenhouse gases. So we're pleased to see that. But on this issue, I'm sorry to say, really disappointment at the big three agencies. And, you know, just one quick example. One of the things that we do at Center for Safety is we've gone around the country and sued to make sure that there are no GMOs in wildlife refuges. Believe it or not, during the Bush administration, they were kind of saying, blank check to you folks. You want to do your experimental GMO growing in wildlife refuges, you go ahead. Well, we found out about that, and that's not legal. You can't do that. So we sued successfully in several wildlife refuges. And then so the Department of Interior came to us and said, hey, you know, you're suing us one by one or five by five. You know, there's we got all these refugees around the country. Why don't we just do one settlement where we say no GMOs and wildlife refugees, and we'll just call it a deal? And we said, great, let's do that. Well, that was kiboshed at the last minute by the White House. We have the emails.
Really?
Yeah, we have the emails. The White House, through the USDA, but from the White House, said, hey, don't make this deal. We don't want to ever give in to anybody who's trying to get rid of the GMOs. So we continue to be very successful. We've gotten them out of a huge number of refuges, dozens and dozens. But it's very, you know, onerous. We have to go, you know, refuge by refuge rather than have this overall deal. So we know that there was that. Again, who was it inside the White House? I mean, most people know David Axelrod made the comment that genetically engineered alfalfa was going to come here to stay and made that part of it. So, but I don't know really who inside the White House and the Office of Technology, Science, Technology, Policy. It's a mystery. Maybe somebody will get a great best-selling book by somebody who will tell us exactly why the Obama administration went so far in the wrong direction in the whole food arena, but certainly with genetically engineered foods.
And when we talk about Oregon and we talk about the recent victories, the Jackson County and the Josephine County, and we have to talk about particularly the Josephine County victory on GMO banning in the context of the Oregon law that Governor Kitzhaber sort of arranged, which is another Democrat sort of being the person at the helm. What can you say about how that influences what we do here in Oregon?
Well, I think it's really important. When we passed the county laws in Mendocino, I mentioned this, Mendocino and three other counties in California, they tried to preempt. They immediately went to the state legislature and tried to preempt four times. Not once, four times. We were able to beat them four times. This last, because of what happened in Kauai and on the Big Island, they tried to preempt like crazy this year during the legislation session in Hawaii. I don't know how we did it. We were able to defeat it. Very close. Very difficult. Sadly, we're not there in Oregon. Sadly, that got through. So, you know, one of the things that I'm really excited by in Oregon because of all the, you know, all of the enthusiasm about this issue in Oregon. Wherever I travel in Oregon, I'm just seeing all this great enthusiasm. And so, you know, we're establishing a group of meetups. You know, I'm sort of, you know, I think a lot of us are tired of just getting online and saying, you know, sign this petition against Monsanto or this. Let's start a real food revolution. Let's start a real food movement from the ground up. So we're starting a group of meetups here across the state, either, again, through our website, centerforfoodsafety.org, or through meetup.com, and just go to the CFS site on Meetup. It's a very, very important, you know, internet way for people to meet up. And we're starting several right now. We want to meet up. Of course, we want to pass the ballot initiative and make sure we're part of that. And we get a great ground game going there, working with our partners and working with the steering committee, which we're on. But we need to repeal that law. And, you know, we need to say to every county in Oregon, you have the right to say no to GMOs. We need to let democracy work. You know, they outspent, I don't know, $1 million they spent in Jackson. And yet the people spoke. and that we need to let every county in Oregon have that right. And so, you know, after we win in November on labeling, the next fight, we can't just disband and say, yay, you know, we need to have a continuing group. And that's the reason for these meetups, a continuing grassroots, ground up food movement, you know, from the ground up food movement, from the soil up, maybe food movement in Oregon that says, hey, this is labeling. Then we've got to get that repealed. Then we've got to do better to support, have the state support, you know, local. We need to support organic, support appropriate scale. We need to go through and say these are definitely the goals, the mission of what we're trying to do here in Oregon. And I would say right after labeling, the very first one is to repeal that law and give counties the right, the democratic right they should have to say no to GMOs. And why? Because the organic farmers there could be contaminated and lose their markets. And why? Because 80% of the crops that are grown in Oregon are exported. And they could lose their export markets anywhere in the world because they don't take GMOs.
Right.
So this isn't just sort of, gosh, we hate these chemical companies. People's lives are on the line. Their livelihoods. Why? Because we don't want farm workers to be inundated with 2,4-D. We don't want even conventional farmers here to have their grapes, their apples, their wheat destroyed by revolatilized dicamba from Monsanto coming in clouds and destroying their farms. They have the right to say no. They have the right to say, the tool that you want to put in here isn't a tool that can work in any toolkit. It destroys all the other tools in the toolkit, and we have the right to say no. And we will not have the state dictate to us what we need to have our farm communities survive. Mm-hmm. So to me, right after the labeling, that's where the food movement, the food revolution in Oregon is going to go, and I hope that's where these meetups end up, really, really pushing that.
Wouldn't it be a ballot measure campaign? Or
I see it as a ballot measure campaign, yeah. The next ballot measure, and hopefully the next ballot measure victory. That's where I would see this going. So I'm glad you brought up that question.
And one thing I wanted to ask you that I forgot to ask earlier in the labeling issue, the concern that was often brought up in the Washington ads with all these seemingly health professionals and others of status talking about how people's cost was going to go up with the labeling. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, so here's the trick, right? Here's their little shell game, all right? Labeling costs almost nothing, right? You know, it's genetically engineered. It's two on raw food, right? That's two words. Produced with genetic engineering, you know, three words, you know, or partially produced, four words with genetic engineering. So that costs nothing. No one. There's no dispute. Companies change every 18 months or so, change their labeling anyway, so that's not a problem. What the other side is saying is what's going to cost is when there's labeling, no one wants to buy the labeled food, and so they're going to have to source for non-GMO seeds, and that's going to cost all this money, and they're going to have to raise their prices. That's their argument. But that's not labeling. Labeling just says, hey, tell the people what's in there. And believe me, these companies, let me remind us, have spent $70 million just in Washington and California to stop labeling, right? So they have plenty of money. They can tell the people, oh, this is the best thing in the world for you. When you see that genetically engineered label, go and buy it. The best thing for you, right? If they have something to sell, compete in the marketplace. If you're telling me, oh gosh, if I have to actually label truthfully, I can't compete in the marketplace. Well, that's your problem. You know, then you've said, I have a product that unless I hide it from people, we can't compete in the marketplace. Well, don't look at me, look at yourselves. Then why don't you try and invent something that will do something for somebody? Because that's the dirty little secret of these biotech companies, Monsanto and the boys, which is that they have not produced a single product that anybody wants to buy. Nobody wakes up in the morning going, boy, do I want to buy a genetically engineered product this morning? No, they found a way to sell a lot more of their chemicals and to make it a little bit easier for large farmers to spray these toxins on their fields. That's it, primarily. That's it, 85% of it. So, you know, if you want to compete, do something for consumers, and then they'll buy. But don't blame me if by telling the truth to consumers, you think you're going to lose out in the market. Mm-hmm. You have all the advertising dollars you would possibly need to advertise. And so that really has nothing to do with labeling. So that's their trick. They're saying, well, gee, we don't have any, all we offer consumers is risk. No benefit. So, gee, we may have to source from non-GMO and that'll cost us. Well, that's a market. That's not even the labeling. Labeling is just about telling the truth. T- tell the truth, and then we'll see what the market decides. And if the market tells you you're going to make more money by sourcing for non-GMOs, then that's what you'll do. If it doesn't, then you won't. But that's that little trick they play. Labeling itself is meaningless. It's pennies. You know, maybe it'll cost the average Oregonian a couple of pennies a year. But that's it. So that's the little trick. And again, it does hide their little secret that in 30 years, and I don't know how many hundreds of millions, billions of dollars they've spent on research, both private and our taxpayer dollars, and they haven't come up with a single trait that would make food healthier or taste better or have lower cost. Yeah, well, maybe you'll have a problem in the marketplace then if people know the truth, because you're not, all you're offering is risk and no benefit. But that's the marketplace. You have to compete in the marketplace like anybody else, Monsanto, and all these other companies. Sorry, that's the way it works. And if you can compete, fine. If you can't compete, why don't you think about a different technology?
And how is it for them competing in the international marketplace? How are GE crops, GE foods viewed outside of the U.S.?
64 other countries have mandatory labeling of some sort. So almost all of our trade partners. So we're, you know, with the exception now of the state of Vermont, which you're happy to say, we're the outliers there, you know, because people have said, hey, this is novel stuff in the food, and people have the right to know, and then make their own decisions. Primarily around the world, somewhere between 5 and 7% of all crops are genetically engineered. Now, in this country, we know 80 to 90% of corn, 80 to 90% soy, a huge amount of cotton, some alfalfa, and some obviously sugar beets. But none of our whole foods are. I mean, virtually nothing. A little bit of papaya out of Hawaii. And so it's really the processed foods is where you see your high fructose corn syrup, your soy lecithin. That's where a lot of your genetically engineered. So when you hear this statistic, 70% of our foods are genetically engineered, remember that's processed foods because of all those processed stuff in them. And the rest of the world has pretty much said no. That's why there's such a low. Most people, when I ask them, how much of the world's crops do you think are genetically engineered? They go 80% or 70%. Mm-hmm. It's about 5%. So, by the way, about as much as certified organic around the world. So, and we know the futures with small, medium-sized organic and sustainable farms, not with huge genetic engineered monocultures, you're not going to feed the world with a huge amount of corn and soy. You know, you can drive your cars with it, but you can't feed the world with it. I think we pretty much know where the future is, and I think the rest of the world realizes that, and we just got to play a little catch up here in the United States.
Yeah, because sometimes when I hear some of those statistics, I think, well, corn and soy, there's no future. There's nothing that can be done, and so the fact that there's some alternative in that area is reassuring.
Yeah, you know, it's not that difficult. Sometimes it seems really complicated. You know, what does sustainable mean? And I'm so confused about that. And I totally get it. But if you really break it down, it's pretty simple, right? To grow a crop, you need soil. You need seed. You need water. You need sun. You need a farmer. And for a lot of food, some pollinators. So how are we doing in our industrial food system? How are we doing with the soil? Not really good. We're losing topsoil at an extraordinary rate, way past the rate it can regenerate itself. That's not good. How are we doing with the seed? Well, we're monoculturing the seed. Monsanto owns 25% of the world's commercial seeds with another couple of chemical companies. Over 50% of the world's commercial seeds are owned by chemical companies. They're monoculturing those seeds. No diversity. That's not very good. How are we doing with water? Well, anybody in California knows what we're doing with water. Aquifers pretty much going down the drain. Colorado River pretty much not there. Too much water being spent for the beef culture and other really stupid ways to spend water. So we turn the sun into an enemy, you know, with climate destabilization. We've eviscerated farmers in my lifetime. We've lost, you know, 10 million farmers, 5 million farms because of this monoculturing and how expensive all these inputs are, you know. And pollinators, CFS, and safety, we have several litigations right now to stop the neonicotinoids that are killing the bees. So we need to save our pollinators. So obviously that system of which the entire industrial system is based on and which GMOs are the sort of the end result of, right, that has no future. That's dead paradigm walking. That's zombie agriculture. That's over. We have to have an agriculture, just sensibly, that regenerates the soil, that has a diversity of seed, that uses water wisely, right? That turns the sun back into a friend, that has a wonderful farm community and farmers around the country, that has a whole new aspect of farming. And for the last couple of years, we have more farmers than we've had before. So it's beginning to happen with organic farms. And of course, we need to save our pollinators. We know the regenerative path here, both on the human and the farm scale and all the way from the soil to the sky. We know how to do this. And that's the new paradigm. That is the future of food we're talking about. their zombie, their industrial zombie food model, you know, that is, it's already over. It's already over. You know, that is, you know, they don't have the oil, they don't have the water, and they don't have the soil. That we can't keep doing that. That won't be here, folks, 50 years from now. Our job, all of us who are in the new food revolution, looking to a new food future, is to get rid of that paradigm as fast as we can, because it's so damaging. It's so cruel to the 10 billion animals it uses. It's so devastating to the farm communities, so devastating to our soil, to our diversity. It's increasing 50%, depending on how you count it, of all global warming gases have something to do with agriculture and forestry. 50%. Look what we're doing to the pollinators, not just the bees, but the monarchs. You know? So, you know, we can see what they're doing, and we can't have another two generations of that. So that's why the organic and beyond future. That's what we do with the Center for Safety and our allies. You know, that's that new food future, because we are the future. It's not a matter of, oh my God, they're a monolith, they're going to win 100 years. No, their paradigm's over, and we just have to get our paradigm in there as quickly as possible.
As we end this interview, again, what can any of our listeners do in their daily lives to respond to the growing presence of GMOs?
A good friend of mine is Ralph Nader. Now, I know Ralph in 2000. I know I can hear some of those. Okay. Oh, I like this guy up until this point, but what's going on with Nader? But he's still a very good friend of mine. But one of my disagreements with Ralph is this idea of consumer. And I just used the word earlier, so I'm as guilty as others at times. I don't like the word consumer. You know, fires consume. Tuberculosis used to be called consumption because it consumed the bodies of the victims, you know. And what a horrible way to think of yourself, or all of ourselves, as consumers, consuming things, you know. So I said, let's get rid of that. Let's get rid of the word consumer, all of us. And let's begin to think of ourselves as creator. Each one of us is a creator, and we are creators. And what we're saying is that every decision we make in the food that we buy, in the food that we grow, in the food that we feed children in our schools, and the food that we have for our communities, the food that we feed people who are too poor to buy food, the food for our elderly, all of that food, right? We need to create a new food future for that food. We need to say we are responsible to make sure that that food is not industrial food, but food that comes from the organic and beyond future, right? We know this is the two great, we're at a crossroads in history right now. We will either buy McDonald's or buy some industrial meat tomorrow. I'm not always on top of this mountain, but each of us, let's at least take the responsibility and say, you know what? If you get on the Center for Food Safety website, we have a guide there. You can avoid GMOs. You can just follow the guide. If you follow that guide, and it's not complicated. I made them do it so even I could do it, and I'm not that good. So you can do it. You can follow it. And if you do that, and you say no to industrial meat, if you say I'm going to buy as local as possible, organic and local as possible, I'm going to look for that certified humane label. I am going to take responsibility as a creator to create a new food future and not make choices for me, for my children, for everyone else that leads into that zombie that zombie industrial food future. I'm a creator, not a consumer. And if I fail, okay, I failed today. I didn't do well today, but I'll do better tomorrow. I will do non-GMO tomorrow. I will not eat industrial meat tomorrow. I will make absolutely certain tomorrow that I buy as much local and I support my local CSA, my local farmer's market as I can. I will make a food commitment, you know, and that's part of what our meetups are going to be about as well, is people are making that commitment. And food is a great thing because it's something we can do something about right now, in the next hour. It's really, really hard to say, I really think we need to end the war in Afghanistan before 2 years from now. I never think we should never have gone around. I really want to close down every nuclear power plant in America. Yes, I really want to address climate change, you know, in a big way. Yes, we all want to do that. But sometimes it's very hard because the system is so great. Food's different. Each of us can make food decisions that together can really fundamentally change this highly destructive system into a regenerative, sustainable, and healthy system. And by empowering ourselves to do that, we create a new paradigm. It's so empowering because we're saying, I am saying this is a new relationship with the farmer, a new relationship with the land, and a new relationship with nature. Saying, hey, we're not going to be manipulators and exploiters of nature. We're going to participate with nature. And that's what organic and beyond means. The future doesn't mean more technology. The future means working more and more closely with the natural laws we know we have to. That's the beauty of the organic and beyond movement. So we can be creators. And again, I'm not, you know, I hate those people that preach, you know, as if they were holier than thou. Sometimes I'm at a restaurant, I make a bad decision. I'm not at the top of that mountain. But if we all know that we're creators and that's our responsibility, you know, we can then every day, every hour, start making those right decisions that help create a new food future as creators and forever put away that consumer label.
again, the email and the phone connection for people who want to participate in the meetups or learn more?
Well, you know, for people who want to get involved, which I hope you all will, in the labeling initiative, the number is 866-620-2762, 866-620-2762, or OregonRightToKnow.org. Please get involved with that. And if you want to get involved in our meetups and the food revolution and repeal that law that's taken democracy away from our counties, please get on our website, centerforfoodsafety.org. We have a great office here in Portland. And you can also get up on the meetup.com and look at the CFS site there.
Andrew Kimbrell, thank you so much for talking with us. It's great to hear your spirit and your information. So thank you so much.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be with you.
I want to let people know again, I've been speaking with Andrew Kimbrell. He is the executive director and founder of the Center for Food Safety. This is Kathleen Stevenson sitting in for Barbara Bernstein on Locust Focus. And you can hear this program later today on the web on kboo.fm/locustfocus. Thanks for listening.
And they found that the genes that were inserted into soybeans transferred into the DNA of the bacteria living inside us, and certain varieties of genetically modified corn are engineered to produce an insecticide living inside us.
I'm looking at the food that's in the grocery store. They say it's safe, everybody eat more. On second thought, I don't really know. It was made with those GMOs. So I'm looking for the non-GMO label. Before I bring it home, I put it on a table. I wanna know if it's verified, so I don't harm myself with genetically modified.
They don't want you to know.
They don't want you to know.
Poison
they grow.
Profits
the show
from those GMOs.
Seeds that they sow.
Gonna hurt us,
we know.
We told them to go.
Say GMO,
no.
Hey, look. I don't wanna eat poison. I don't want gene mutations at my dinner reservations. It's a food abomination. What they're doing to this fast food nation. They take artificial gene combinations, inject them in seed variations so they can grow their frankenfood imitations while the side effects cause medical patients. Keep the profits alive while they're spraying all the food with name brand herbicides. And all the while they're spreading their lies. Monsanto destroy a farmer's lives. And the FDA just keeps it all going, saying it's safe even though they all know it's just poison, stealing away your life. And that's what you eat, but genetically modified.
And you do have it tuned to KBOO in Portland. It is 7 minutes past 11 a.m. And Health Watch is off today, but instead we will hear Economic Update with host Richard Wolf. And he talks about the economics of advertising and privatization. So stay tuned for that. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
How I'd love to wander back.
Hi there, this is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
In 2011, Troy Davis was executed by the state of Georgia despite a compelling case of innocence. This sparked a global movement to end the death penalty. Hear a firsthand account of his story and readings from the book I Am Troy Davis on Prison Pipeline, June 16th at 6:30 p.m.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches, for breakfast and lunch and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO. Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffeehouse. And now here we will take you to Economic Update with Richard Wolf.
One of these days, things gonna change. One of these days.
Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program exploring the economic aspects of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, our hopes for the future, our hopes for the jobs our children may be able to get. My name is Richard Wolf. I'm the host of Economic Update. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and currently I teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns for truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis that I urge you to check out, truthout.org. Let me begin with a piece of what I think is good news. It's not that often that we have that in looking at the economic realities we face these days around the world. But on Thursday, a week ago, roughly, the Rhode Island Senate passed a remarkable bill. And in this bill, the Rhode Island Senate said that in state contracts, that is when the state of Rhode Island buys everything from paper clips to road materials to computers, preference will be given to firms that pay their executives less than 32 times their lowest employees' pay. Now, let's be clear. The Rhode Island Senate is sending a message, and I will actually quote the state senator, Kathy.